to 1, consider public employee appointment for the position of Director of Public Works. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour notice hearing requirement. Amendment number 2 to the October 21st, 2014 board agenda. Addendum to item number 4, a resolution recognizing HMR Vineyards for their 50th anniversary. Staff is replacing the resolution to revise some of the wording. District 1. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour notice requirement.
All right. And just for the record here, we will not be conducting closed session today as there are no topics or need for us to do that. So, sorting out the blizzard here, let me take public comment on the consent agenda. We'll start with District Attorney Shea, followed by Richard Margetts, and followed by Doug Ryan, Public Works.
Good morning, Jerry Shea, District Attorney. I wanted to make a few comments just briefly about item number 8. On behalf of the Anti-Gang Coordinating Commissioner, the AGCC, the one-year pilot program to allow the probation department to hire an employment coordinator to assist ex-gang offenders in successfully transitioning back into their community by obtaining gainful employment upon release. This is one of the items that has been on our strategic plan for a number of years and one of those gaps that we were hoping to be able to fill through this particular employment coordinator position. As you may recall, about 3 or 4 months ago, we came to your board with a presentation, the sheriff, the chief probation officer, and myself, talking about the three different components within the AGCC, the prevention component, the suppression component, and the rehab and reentry component. And this particular item relates mainly to the rehab and reentry component. We believe that this particular person could put together apprenticeship programs for ex-offenders, put together work readiness programs, and then most importantly, contact employers who would be willing and able to hire those who are willing to turn their lives around, basically. And that's really what we embrace this for. So just a quick mention that the AGCC and all the members of the AGCC are supportive of this particular item, especially in light of the fact that we believe it's going to reduce recidivism and help our mission, which is to prevent and reduce the magnitude and frequency of gang crimes in our county.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Mr. Ryan, followed by Richard Margetson.
Good morning, Doug Ryan, Public Works County Surveyor. Just amend item 10, the first paragraph under discussion states that the Subdivision Review Board approved the tentative map. It was actually denied by the SRB and approved upon appeal by the Board of Supervisors. And I've submitted that change to the clerk and copies for each of you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Mr. Margetson.
Item 7, basically a procedural item, but reading the staff report, there's a pattern that's developing with ordinances affecting Los Osos or amendments to ordinances or new ordinances in Los Osos. They always seem to come forward and before the public during the holiday season. This hearing is November 25th, 2 days before Thanksgiving. Rates and charges ordinance for Los Osos. That is going to have to be redone. Came before the community right before Christmas. It's a pattern that keeps happening. Title 8 and Title 19, when they were adopted originally in the ensuing years, had to be revised 4 times. The charts in those ordinances were changed 4 times because of public input. Now you're going to, through cost savings, circulate the notices on a more limited basis. Is it really in the best interest of the public for not having to not have full disclosure? for the little added cost. And the line that gets me in this is under the results section. This is consistent with the county goal of a prosperous and well-governed community. Really? Not full disclosure? Holding it at inopportune times for the public? But it's Los Osos again. And Los Osos.
Request to speak. So I'll close the public comment, bring it back to the board to ask colleagues if they have items to pull. Ms. Arnold?
I do. 5 and 9, please.
Mr. Hill?
None, sir.
Mr. Meacham?
None, thank you.
And Ms. Ray?
Nope.
Ms. Arnold on number 5.
Yes. So number 5 on our agenda is creating a new position for Chief Wastewater Treatment Plant Operator, $144,000 a year position cost to the county. And it looks like from the staff report it'll be funded from Fund 405 Public Works, adding a full-time employee. Most of the responsibility would be the Los Osos Water Recycling Facility and other wastewater collection systems. So I had a few questions. Where are the other, I don't know, I'm looking at Dan, I'm looking at Public Works. Where are the other wastewater collection systems that would be overseen by this new person?
Mr. Benedict.
Good morning. Dean Benedict, Utilities Division Manager. The long-range concept we have is that we have 4 wastewater treatment systems. There was one at Oak Shores up in North County. The Country Club is another one, and then the Pomo is a force main system that we maintain besides Los Osos. And the long-term idea is we would have a centralized wastewater division that would handle those instead of having them split up in the North and South County as we do right now.
So right now there's somebody in your department that just works on those part of their course of business.
That's correct.
Okay. And then, so I understand this position with Los Osos is more or less mandated, or at least with the Los Osos new treatment plant, mandated by the State Water Resources Control Board. But my concern is the cost to the county. Is this I guess it will be a permanent position because it looks like you're trying to kind of restructure.
Yes, with the addition of Los Osos plant, we have enough operational facilities that it makes a lot of sense to have a centralized staff that has just wastewater specialty experience and operational interest. Yes.
My recollection and the reason this jumped out at me is when I was working for Assemblyman Blakeslee, and he authored AB 2701 to take that wastewater, the sewer responsibility from the CSD and work on it through the county. I remember that eventually, or I thought the long-range plan was that all things wastewater in Los Osos would eventually be returned to the CSD. So do we envision a timeline for that responsibility of wastewater in Los Osos to transition back to the CSD?
I think that concept was under consideration, and we're not certain exactly when or that may happen. We anticipate probably for 2 or 3 years as the plant starts up. It certainly will be under the district's purview, and we anticipate that we will be developing a 5-year plan for transition to this, if that makes sense, and bring it to your board to consider at a later time.
Okay, and then my last question was the mechanism for the funding for this position, and if that in part would come from the 218 funding.
The funding from this comes from the maintenance and operation fund that will be established for the payment for the services, the operation maintenance of Los Osos plant.
So as long as the county is responsible for the wastewater situation in Los Osos, the cost of funding this position and whatever else comes along will be on the county, and then possibly if that transition takes place in the next few years, that funding mechanism would be revisited? Is that kind of where we're going?
Well, the different funding groups pay for the services they provide. So if it were to be broken up, Oak Shores would pay a portion of that cost, et cetera.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. If that's all on number 5, then number 9.
Yep. So for number 9, I'd like to pull it for a separate vote, abstain from the vote. My son was a subcontractor on some fence building to replace fencing in that job.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, then, I would entertain a motion on consent absent number 9.
So moved.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Hill, with the second. With that, a roll call vote.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And then I'd entertain a motion on number 9.
So moved.
Thank you, Mr. Hill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ray.
Can I ask a question?
Certainly.
What is the concern on this?
Oh, for me, it was abstaining. My son was a sub on the job.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Potential 700. So with that and noting Ms. Arnold's abstention, Madam Clerk?
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
And then abstain. Thank you.
Actual recusal. So there we are. That is consent. We thank you very much. We are going to go to general public comment. First, let me offer the lectern to our esteemed clerk recorder.
Thank you, Board. Julie Rodewald, County Clerk Recorder. We are now 14 days till the November 4th election. So just an update. Yesterday was to encourage people, if you're still interested, we'd love to have backups because people do get sick or have emergencies, and they can find information on slovote.com. That's it.
Is that the best way? Is there a phone number you might relate?
Let's see if I remember it. 781-4109. We'll get them to a voicemail system so that we can return the calls.
Very good. And, Madam Clerk Recorder, as we get close to elections, we had came up last week. These chambers are within 100 feet of a polling place.
Correct.
We do. And so we do not allow electioneering.
Right.
At this point.
We request that there be no electioneering. It's a difficult position, I think, and County Council can probably speak to it. If there is discussion about, like, any of the propositions in here, we'll turn the TVs off, so at least you can't hear that in our lobby. But certainly at any other polling place or if somebody's in our office or out in the lobby, yes, they cannot be campaigning. And we would love it if nobody campaigns in here, too.
Well, I think that's proper, and as I am about to open it up to the public for comment on items not on the agenda, I will remind the commenters that this is a segment for items that are within the purview of the board, and comments regarding other elections of other bodies are not part of our general public comment. So with that,
thank you.
I don't see questions from my colleagues, and we will go then to general public comment. Start with Julie Tacker, followed by Lindy Owen.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker, and I just have some kind of random questions. Ms. Ray, during some of your forums, you said that you waived the permit fee for the Oceano Farmers Market. And I'm curious, I believe that fee to be about $5,000. Would that $5,000 then come from your discretionary fund? Even if it was $5, does that come from your discretionary funds? I was under the impression that the planning department had the ability to waive those fees because it's they who are doing the work. I don't know that they need your approval. Just a question. And then when I'm thinking about community project funds and the discretion that each of you have, last year, Supervisor Gibson approved $950 to celebrate Los Osos. In funding half of their party for the contractors for the wastewater project. And that money paid for cake and a band, sodas, hot dogs. To me, as a taxpayer, that doesn't sound like a good use of taxpayer money. And had I known that those were taxpayer-funded hot dogs, being a taxpayer, may have participated, but chose not to, as did most of my community. The estimate of attendance was about 125 people, and $950 of the cake, hot dogs, sodas, was paid for by the rest of the county. And while we're not electioneering, that day was a fabulous photo op for then-candidate Supervisor Gibson in his reelection bid for the primary in June. And I wanted to bring that to your attention, and I would ask County Council in the future that all discretionary funds be put on consent calendars so that the public has full view of what's going on without having to use the Public Record Act to see how you, five supervisors, are using your discretionary funds. And they should be under the scrutiny of the public to say whether cake, sodas, and hot dogs are the best use of taxpayer monies.
Ms. Owen, followed by Eric Green.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos. Last week you had your afternoon session on pretty much the water summit, and the discussion of the status of the Los Osos Basin adjudication and the ISJ interlocutory stipulation judgment process came up, and that is now going on between six and 10 years of trying to balance our basin. And Mr. Gibson laughed and said that maybe, you know, not in his lifetime would he see the end of that basin settlement. On those kinds of warnings, it'll do nothing but yield chaos and irreversible damage, stuff that we can't afford to fix. So like our water basin, well, like climate change, our water basins need to be addressed much more in an adult fashion and with some responsibility. In Los Osos, we had many players. That basin was noted to be in saltwater intrusion 40 years ago under the county's watch. The county was running the show, and yet we kept building more and more houses. At this point, we need to put in the sewer, but all these ads keep saying that you can build after 5 years after the sewer goes in and the wells are upgraded. Here's another one. You can build your dream home as soon as the sewer moratorium is lifted. This is all a bunch of crap because there's no water. There is no future growth in Los Osos unless, you know, we have a miracle of some kind. So I really hope that you all get real, and there's no water, there's no growth, and then rain dances and prayers are about all we have left.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Mr. Greening, followed by Richard Margetson.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I also wanted to follow up on the Water Summit. First, thank you for having it, and thank you and all of the staff that put the work into it and pulling together the information. There were some very useful parts of it, such as the enumeration of various sources of assistance for farmers and others affected by the drought and the different pots, the different criteria for those different sources, the different people for whom it would be appropriate. The review of the legislation was also very useful. I did not agree with the decision at the end. In fact, now, for the very same reason the county is supporting the creation of this district over the Paso Robles groundwater basin, which was that three people not of the basin would be making decisions for the basin. But now that the county is preparing the application on behalf of the basin, that is exactly what will happen, that the contents of that application will be coming from a board, most of which doesn't represent the basin. In the meantime, understanding the requirements of Pavley Dickinson, I can see the need for follow-up action, not specific to the district, but to the basin as a whole, because the groundwater sustainability plan must account for the entire basin, either one plan or multiple plans which coordinate with each other and are consistent with each other. One way or another, it's not going to be up to the district to write the plan. If they create themselves, they might be participants. It's going to be up to a number of entities, and one of the first things that needs to happen is for those entities to get together and decide who will take the lead on this. So the next summit should be an actual summit meeting, a joint meeting of your board and that of Monterey County, because this can't happen without them. And then figure out how to ensure the we want to ensure precipitation too. But the participation of the incorporated cities, relevant districts such as Templeton Community Services District, Atascadero Mutual Water Company. We have to reincorporate the Atascadero subbasin. It is part of the Bulletin 118 boundaries of the basin. And just essentially map out structurally who, if anyone, is going to take the lead in the effort of the plan or the coordination of the plans. What will be the process for getting there? There are next steps that have to be taken regardless of whether the district forms itself or not.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Greening. Mr. Margetson, followed by Ben DeFato.
Richard Margetson, you've heard me say before that things with Los Osos would start coming to fruition. Let's speak about an example today. March 20th, 2012, recycled water contract with the school district was placed on the school district's agenda for Los Osos. No advance notice to either purveyor, either major purveyor, that would be affected by this. That evening, as a member of the subcommittee of the Los Osos CSD that was developing the new rate structure for the Los Osos CSD Water District, we had concerns because the rate structure was going to be adjusted and that rate was going to go up dramatically to help pay for ISJ things, infrastructure things, and the like. 2 months later, I submitted a three-page, on behalf of the committee, three-page analysis of the impacts of the contract to the CSD Board of Directors. I found this last night. I was going to come talk about the contract, but I found my analysis from that point in time. I went through it. Every point in there has come to fruition. And one of the major points was that somewhere down the road, when this actually comes into play, the CSD would only be receiving about 50% of the going rate at that time. Because the new rate structure increased the rate for the highest tier to $7.20. Right now, we're having another increase. $4.28 is what the district will receive. I'm going to give you a copy of this. I got a copy for everybody. Please look at it. Everything in here is correct and verified by the committee
that
put it together.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. Your time is up. Mr. DeFato, followed by Joyce Albright.
Are you not going to pass them along?
Good morning, Board. Ben DeFato from Los Osos. Well, you all missed a well-attended celebration, a 40th-year celebration of the People's Helping People Party Saturday. Not even one person from this board, especially Mr. Gibson or the CSD. I just want to tell you about a few things of us that come here every week after week. First, let's not forget those that have departed this side of heaven for their time and energy trying to put some sense into your heads that many are just trying to survive this board's decisions. Believe me, this is not a selfish act by us. We're not here for fame or just to be on TV. The few of us that come here love Los Osos and this county. It certainly appears that you are mad at me for my complaining about your faults, and believe me, if you can't get along with me, something is wrong with you and you should quit your job. Despite how cruel you treat us seniors and elderly, we continue to hear how you think you know what is best for everyone at others' expense. It was this county and Mr. Gibson's purview that took forever to come up with a basin plan to save our basin, while all the time saltwater intrusion was closing in at a fast pace. That was a failure. A few years back, the county and others, in your purview, allowed 1,100 homes to be built, knowing that eventually there would be a serious water overdraft to the point we are almost losing our only source of drinking water. That was a failure. It was in your purview that doing that several thousand property owners have to sell their homes because you built a $200 million sewer system that several thousand property owners can't afford. That was a failure, too. It was under this county's and those with misguided ideas purview to build a stinking sewer plant right in the middle of town. It was in your purview to dump a million gallons of water for recharging purposes high up on a hill where many homes and citizens reside below within a short distance that were in danger of devastating landslide. That was a failure. And under your purview, you used the same engineer to do study after study that said the Broderson site is where they recommend to recharge our aquifer. Till another engineer that you hate said, are you crazy? Don't you remember the landslide down in La Conchita with the same sand conditions that killed seven people in the sleep? That was a failure. Sir, I have 30 seconds more, and I just can't take it anymore. You really beat me up, sir. I used to have a nun at the fifth grade used to beat me up physically. You beat me up mentally, and I resent that. And I know you're going to say something now, but I'm not here.
Ms. Albright.
Greetings from Los Osos. I'm also from Los Osos. I'm Joyce Albright. I came here, number one, to express my appreciation to the county for the progress that is being made on our sewer. Friends who have toured the 20% completed facility were very impressed and were greatly anticipating its completion. My concern now is the monthly fees. I hope accommodations can be made for those of us who are on a fixed budget. Equally important is the choice our community makes for CSD board members in the next month's election. I know you mentioned I can't refer to this, but this refers to our relationship with you. We must choose intelligent, responsible individuals so that the hookups to the sewer will go smoothly, plus those elected officials must be willing to cooperate and work with the county on the basin plan. In that regard, I'm concerned that the background of two of the people running may not be familiar to our newer citizens and that some members of the community may have forgotten their history. In 2005, Chuck Cesena,
okay, first of all, Mr. Margetson, you may leave. I've talked to you about blurting out. You may leave the chambers right now.
Need to be put people on that board who will cooperate with you and who will not reverse this situation the way they did before. It's ironic that the same group that's complaining about saltwater intrusion is the group that stopped the last sewer. So I'm hoping that we won't return to the same animosity that we had with you and the board before we were trying to put the sewer in before.
Thank you, Ms. Albright.
Thank you.
Dr. Height, you know well that we need this. Excuse me. If you want to argue with me, just hang on. If you know well that our policy is, if you want to argue with me, madam, I'm going to ask you to leave as well. I'm going to make an accommodation to you, Ms. Height. I'm going to make an accommodation to you because you know well that we want speaker slips for general public comment on the dais. You may speak now, Dr. Height, but this will be the last time I take your slip late. Ms. Owen, you are excused. You can leave the chambers. You can leave the chambers while Dr. Height gets ready to speak. The deputies will escort you out.
You removed me. I did nothing.
You blurted out. You're disrupting. You're now again disrupting the meeting. I would like you to leave, please, right now. And if you don't, we're going to call a short recess. Madam Clerk, we're going to call a short recess. All right. Now we're back in business. Again, we're going to continue general public comment. And again, the ground rules here are that we speak on items that are within the purview of this board under its subject matter jurisdiction. The disruptions we've had, I've warned those participants before that blurting out from the back of the audience disrupts this meeting, and I'm simply not going to tolerate it. It's clear to me that that kind of disruption would be cause for not having folks in the room in any board chambers in this state. So with that, Dr. Height, your public comment, please, items not on the agenda and within our purview.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. Thank you for letting me speak today. I very much would like to come to this chamber and share with you the good things that are happening in this community that are within your purview. Healing and supporting the community is within your purview. Healing Los Osos is within your purview. And it has come to me from different sources. Heal, don't hurt. Heal Los Osos. There are different people in the community that are using their artistic gestures to be non-political and try to support this community. And that's what the money that went for the Celebrate Los Osos was supposed to be about. It was board money. It was to bring the community together, and the community did come together. They were civil. We participated. I brought my funny, humorous artwork as a gesture, and everyone was civil, and Los Osos came together. So as the chair and as the board, I'm asking you to begin the healing process. And it begins in this room. And it begins with all of you to support and heal the community. And I would like to invite unofficially each and every one of you to consider that Los Osos is an aging community. And you support nonprofits. And I would like you to support the Wilshire Hospice, because all of us are going to need it. This is not just district specific. All districts can support. And on November 1st, they are holding a Day of the Dead celebration in the Mission Plaza. And each supervisor could support Wilshire Hospice, and you could support the artists that are supporting Wilshire Hospice. So that is November 1st in the plaza, and I really hope to see all of you there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Height. That was our last request to speak, and so we'll close public comment and move on with our board business for the day. Madam Clerk, would you introduce our next item, please?
Item number 16, submittal of a status report on the San Luis Obispo County's 2011 Public Safety Realignment Implementation Plan, all districts.
All right. I would expect we have a team approach here. Chief Salio, are you?
The county would best suit our local environment. So we're going to talk a little bit about where we are with the plan. And as a reminder, our goals were to maintain public safety. That's paramount. We also want to improve the offender success rate, that they don't recidivate, they don't come back into prison, because we know that's the best way to reduce the population in prison and in county jails is not to have the offenders come back. And then look for alternatives to incarceration to support low-level offenders to help them return to the community in a productive manner. So we're going to concentrate on the three areas of realignment that have affected our county. One is the housing at the county jail, the supervision done by the probation department, and the treatment of offenders, which is primarily the responsibility of our behavioral health services. And we actually have some videos today to show you, so we'll make it a little more media interactive. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Captain Cole, who will talk a little bit about the jail services.
Good morning.
Captain. Good morning.
I think the most significant impact to the county jail since realignment has been the increase in population. You can see by the chart that pre-realignment, the population of 477 was pretty consistent until realignment started in the end of 2011. But by 2014, we have an increase of 749 inmates in custody, which was a 59% or 57% increase. Currently, with our jail population, 30 to 35% of our population is an AB 109 offender. So what does this all mean to all of us? I think we all see that AB 109 impacts the jail in a much broader way, and in just not in just in the increasing of numbers. Current law has allowed jail sentences of unlimited length. Therefore, inmates are now staying longer in our county jails. The longer stays have also influenced the jail culture, prison and gang politics that was previously ignored at the county jail level is now a problem. Larger population and longer stays has also attributed to the increased number of assaults. The 2010 stats showed there were 60 assaults compared to 149 in 2013. These incidents also trigger an increase in the need for inmates requesting protective services or protective custody, which also limits how we house inmates in our county jail because of limited space. This was just a slide to just show you a visual picture of some of the impacts of the increased population. This is our women's dorm unit. Since we're unable to change the physical size of the jail, we've had to take different steps to ensure the safety and security of the staff and inmates. In order to do that, we've had to kind of change our philosophy and the way we are running our jail. We've had to change designated bed capacity by adding more beds to almost every housing unit. Again, changing our philosophy and how we house inmates to allow greater flexibility in grouping inmates together in different classifications without creating other issues has also been a problem. With the increased bed capacity, we've also had to increase staffing in each of the housing locations. We've also looked at increased use of alternatives to jail incarceration, including promises to appear in court, site releases, alternative service programs, and, of course, sheriff's parole. We've also looked at every inch of our land and space, and in order to provide more jail space within the jail for our high to medium security inmates, we relocated our women's honor farm to the facility next to the men's honor farm, and that's actually worked out better for us, giving them more opportunities and also allowing us to house more inmates at the jail. I think everyone is aware that AB 109 has impacted the jail in many different ways, but it's also, along with its difficulties, created a lot of opportunities. It's allowed us to do a lot of different things to try to decrease recidivism, and one of the ways we're doing that is providing in-custody programs, doing more alternative sentencing with home detention and sheriff's parole, and using different programs to assist to avoid future criminal behavior. Again, I know I've said this before, one of our biggest successes at the jail, I think, has been collaborating with a lot of our community and county providers. The jail programs unit is a collaboration between jail staff, probation, behavioral health, and it has allowed us to identify high-risk inmates and get them the skills and treatment they need, provide the treatment in custody, and then assist with the transition to the community. Another big thing has been the Affordable Care
Act. Well, being a gang member, it was a thing to do. Growing up like that, my life took a turn, took a whole different turn. I started taking money from my parents. I started doing drugs. I started getting tattoos, and stuff just happened so fast. You know, you're talking at the age 13, 14, 15, 16, fast. And that's where I started to get deeper into the gang part of it. The way it caught me in the cycle was already like, you know, I was an adult and, you know, doing drugs and drinking, like living in that atmosphere, it just starts to become addicting. You're just addicted and you just keep going. I went into jail, you know, every year from 18 up until 26, then I went to prison again. I was scared to really say it or to really ask for things or to like express myself. So I kept a lot of it bottled in, and I thought about all my past stuff. I thought about all the blessings. I thought about all the downfalls. I thought about all the ups and downs. I thought about all those things, but I had it all inside of me. I didn't want to like say it or share it because like, you know, there's like homes around. They're like hard homies. Like, they ain't playing. You think they have anything to lose? Well, if you're about it, then you're with us. You understand with us. Well, yeah, it's true. But at the same time, like, I was afraid. But I still had good homies. in those people that I was standing with, telling me to do good, telling me to do right. So basically, I just kept my mouth shut, and I just watched and observed everything around me. When I left that prison, I told myself, I don't ever want to go back. And I didn't go back. I was blessed. You know, God was so gracious to me to like reveal himself again to me and to show me that I'm still here. It's you that keeps walking away. I'm still right here in front of you. I'm still here calling you, but you're the one that walked away from me. And this time that I didn't get to go back to prison, which was a blessing, and I stood on the farm at San Luis County, that's where Restorative Partners came in. Sister Teresa, how she shows you, like, how to love. She tells you, looks at you in your eyes, and tells you that she loves you. I love you, sister. Thank you for everything you've done for me. I appreciate it. And that's Restorative Partners. Are they important? Of course they're important. We need those kind of programs, because if we don't have those kind of programs, they ain't going to be. There ain't going to be really nothing to run to, because, I mean, that's what I ran to. You know, God was so gracious to me. And he opened the door. He opened the door for me to make a chocolate chip cookie. And it sounds funny, but I promise after the Lord, that's what it was. He opened the door for me to make a chocolate chip cookie at San Luis Obispo County Honor Farm in my own soil, my own backyard, and for me to make a change here.
So this individual was in and out of prison and jail for 17 years. He did do our time in our jail instead of going to prison. He got involved with all the programs in custody along with the vocational training at the Honor Farm in our kitchen. This slide shows you the number of individuals who voluntarily participate in programs. These are your AB 109 offenders, and it looks like a lot of them are taking advantage of the different programs in custody. Again, I just want to emphasize the importance of collaboration, because we have limited resources, and working with other agencies and nonprofits has enabled us to do internships at Thousand Hills, which helps educate our inmates and provides job opportunities. Alternatives to Violence is another class provided by a nonprofit, and also our drug and treatment programs have been successful. So what are the challenges and what does the future bring? We would like to start using more of the validated assessment tools to identify more clearly the risk and needs of a specific inmate and partner them with providers and get them the treatment that they need. We need to continue to expand our community partnerships because, again, with limited resources, they're a valuable resource to us in providing a lot of different programs and reentry services. We need to get better at collecting data, sharing and not duplicating work. Finding more efficient ways to collect data and share it is going to be a priority for us. And then the Women's Jail Expansion Project, now going on with the AB 900 funding, will provide us additional housing and additional medical mental health office space and programming units. I think the sheriff wanted to talk about.
Thank you. Ian Parkinson, County Sheriff. Just wanted to point out one other challenge that's potentially on the horizon that you're probably aware of, Prop 47. Prop 47 is a reduction of felonies to misdemeanors. Most of your major drugs would be reduced.
A few questions. I would assume we're going to hear from probation and possibly the DA as well.
And behavioral.
And then just one last thing, you know, this is a picture of our Women's Jail Expansion Project that's going pretty close to plan, so we're hoping by 2016 the new Women's Jail will be up and running. And then, of course, one more last video, because I want to leave it on a positive note. I think we can talk about challenges and difficulties, but I think it's also important to highlight some of our successes, and what we're doing seems to be working, especially because we're able to work together. And this is, again, another video clip from this inmate that has been in a custody for a long time who's doing very well.
John, the evidence speaks for itself. Well, like, the evidence does speak for itself. Like, look where I'm at today. Look where I'm at today. I enjoy my life right now. It's cool. I go work at the bakery. I mean, who are people like you guys? I got sisters can change. It ain't true. I guarantee you could have. Because I straight went from banging to baking. And in the middle of that, all the frosting and chocolate chips and all that are so many stories, so many different flavors and tastes. I only told you a little bit.
Thank you, Captain. That's that is an uplifting. Let me ask colleagues if they have questions. Ms. Ray?
I don't have a question. I just wanted to make a quick comment that about a year ago I got a chance to tour the jail with many of you sitting here in this room. And I toured the kitchen, and the sheriff handed me 4 bags of samples of food. And I took them and put them on the front seat of my car, and I had such a busy day. I was so grateful to have that food. And I'm telling you, it was good food. That would rival House of Bread. I'm not kidding.
Oh.
And on top of that, the job training is just incredible. And that is no cafeteria. That is truly a great institution, and the work you're doing is fantastic.
In my own question is in terms of your challenges of supervision. You referenced the jail politics, the gang politics, and it concerns me that in order to get inmates to the point of these programs, which can be rehabilitative, restorative to them, you probably have to navigate some of them through some very difficult gang politics. And I'm curious, in the jail, we know that a different breed of criminal is adding to our jail population. Are we seeing the prison gangs in contrast to the street gangs? I mean, we make a differentiation, right, between the street gangs that are operating in our community and a very different kind of entity, which are gangs that operate in prison. And actually, for those who haven't read it, the Atlantic Monthly this month has a very interesting article on prison gangs in California. Are we focusing on the potential of these prison gangs being part of our jail culture at this point?
Yes, and our classification unit is really busy trying to manage this group of this population, because they do have a lot of control in our jail. But I think when I talked about increasing number of inmates who are wanting protective custody, there are people that are saying, no, we don't want to be a part of that. And I think part of the programming we're doing by bringing the programs to the housing units kind of shifts what inmates can and can't do. And we are managing it the best we can, but it is a challenge because they are going to continue to do and conduct business within their jail. We also in the jail, and we also have, you know, the Santa Barbara gangs now coming into San Luis Obispo a lot more and getting housed in our county jail, which again creates a lot more difficulties for us. But right. I think there is a kind of a shift, because you saw this inmate here, Chavez. He was part of that culture, but I think when you create these opportunities and challenge them to meet them, I think they can make different choices.
Okay. Well, I focused on your comment that with the challenges come these new opportunities. I'm very excited about it. We're going to hear from probation and others who are really on the front line of some of the newer things that we're doing. But we also know that our effort to cut recidivism is going to cause some short-term, hopefully short-term problems in your custody division. And it was glad to hear that you are appreciating a lot of the dynamics that might help.
It's a huge problem. I'm not going to, you know, sugarcoat it. It's a problem, but we're, you know, using all the resources we can to try to meet those challenges. Also, programs like the Liberty Tattoo Program, inmates are taking those opportunities to get all the gang tattoos removed from their body, especially the ones that are really visible. So there's hope.
Good.
So I think I'm going to now introduce Chief Deputy Robert Reyes, and he's
going to
talk about probation.
Mr. Reyes.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Gibson, members of the board. Robert Reyes with the Probation Department. I'll be discussing supervision and probation.
Yellow light to your left, probably.
Okay, sorry about that. I'll be discussing our supervision responsibilities to the realigned population. This first slide here is a chart just indicating where we have really two additional populations we now deal with since 2011, the first being our post-release population, and again, those individuals that are released from state prison and report to the probation department, and the other population is our mandatory supervision population, and these are offenders that are sentenced to the county jail for a prison commitment, and part of that prison commitment is suspended, and they are placed on mandatory supervision through probation. The majority of those offenders currently that are sentenced to prison and county jail, most of them often are given a prison sentence where there is no mandatory supervision component to it. Next slide, it's looking at our trends in populations. As you can see from this, our post-release population is declining. This was expected as less and less individuals are eligible for state prison commitments. They are being sentenced to county jail. At the same time, we are seeing a slow growth in our mandatory supervision cases. Between January 13th and January 14th, as you can see, there was a huge increase in the number of individuals sentenced to mandatory supervision. Again, this one just shows the growth in our mandatory supervision cases. Again, it has been slow, but with as we have grown our infrastructure in terms of treatment and services, I think there's been a more willingness from the courts and our justice partners to agree to agreeing to a split sentence and mandatory supervision for individuals. Now, we expect in January of 2015, there's been some legislative changes that requires the court to sentence individuals who are committed convicted for a felony to a split sentence that has the mandatory supervision component. So we expect that the court will be sentencing more individuals. The positive thing with this is that they will serve a shorter amount of time in jail, but when they are released, they will be supervised by the probation department. It will allow us to work with them and tie them into the services that we know they are in need of. And so I think that's a positive thing from that legislative change. In terms of our this population, they are generally, by huge margins, 87%. They are, based on our risk assessment tool, they're very high to high medium risk of reoffending. What that means is that there's somewhere in the range of 40 to 75% probability that they will reoffend. But these are the folks we want to supervise. These are the individuals that we are closely monitoring in the community, and we have them quickly tied into treatment services that they need. This chart really shows what their criminogenic needs are. And just to explain what criminogenic needs are, it's those behaviors, thought patterns, characteristics that are most correlated or most related to reoffending. And that's really based on the correctional research that has been done. As you can see, a lot of our offenders really lack a lot of positive pro-social interests or activities in their lives. They tend to want to associate with other antisocial criminal individuals. They have very strong relationships with that population. They often lack a family or a positive support system, or they have family or marital problems that really impede their ability to change their lifestyle. And then about half of them really have a significant substance abuse issue, and many of them lack the employment and educational skills that really are needed for them to really have a successful transition back into the community. So these are some of the challenges we are facing with this population. When we get to the treatment part of this presentation, I think we've done a really good job of addressing these.
And could you just, the leisure recreation on the far left?
I always need to explain that. Really what that is that they really don't have any ties into pro-social or pro-social activities in the community. So, for example, they may have no ties to faith-based churches. They may not have any sort of ties to community service organizations. They really just don't have any interests or hobbies that I would deem pro-social. And that's really what leisure and recreation means. The issue of homelessness with... And again, Dr. Graber will discuss the amount of sober living beds we've used with this population. And this is our three-year average recidivism rate. And what I really want to point out here is that we haven't seen much of a difference between the rate that our realigned population commits a new offense as compared to a felony probation population. And the good news about that is I believe that what we have in place, our infrastructure and our services and our way we supervise them, is making a difference in preventing them from committing further crimes while under our supervision. And with that, unless there's any questions from members of the board, I will turn it over to Dr. Star Graber from Behavioral Health.
Good morning. So the first thing that happens is the offender gets out of prison or jail, and where do they show up? They show up at probation in a meeting called the Post-Release Offender Meeting, or the PROM. And right, and we once they are in the PROM, we're going to show you a little video about that. Then they go into treatment, and our rate from being assessed or screened into treatment is very good. About 82% of those coming from prison go into treatment once they get their screening, and 92% from the mandatory supervision or the local county jail. So we're going to show you a little bit about what happens at PROM and how we're working all together.
We're here today to have our weekly meeting in collaboration with the Department and Drug and Alcohol Services. We collaborate to go over the present cases that we have in treatment and disease management and doing our coexisting disorder programs. And we also go over the cases that are going to be showing up at the PROM today and process those as far as what they might need for their assessments. The best help to serve the clients that are just getting out of custody.
It's the post-release offender meeting. It's an opportunity for offenders that were just recently released from state prison or county jail to meet with a probation officer, also to meet with drug and alcohol services to determine what level of care and needs they need. They are also afforded an opportunity to get housing for sober living if they don't already have housing. Give them outside resources, do a health and time employment, and any other means that may
be all those looking into assist you to meet with your joint officers, case manager, and the probation officer. The goal here is the same for you as it is for us, when you can succeed against state, and you can complain and have to go back to state prison.
Compared to all the other programs I've been involved in, and I've worked several with our probation before, but this one in particular, because we have the resources, because we're all together, just a team aspect, you get somebody to come in, the main issue generally are with substance abuse, and we have those experts here on site, ready to go, take assessments, we can get socially committed right away, and we can get people out. When you get somebody that's coming right out of state prison, generally they're going to be homeless. And that's not just a risk to the community, but it's a risk to that person as well. And if you can get them in here, and we can then not only assess the problems they have with substance abuse, but get them a roof over their head. And that works wonders. Then you have to be released and report a week later to probation, still homeless, no roof, no money, no transportation, no assessments. So having everything there is basically to take care of them.
So a little bit about these offenders. Approximately 27% also have mental health co-occurring disorders. And so in 13-14, we added a mental health therapist to the team who sees these particular offenders in specialty mental health services. The drugs that we're working with, the drugs of choice are still methamphetamine for this population, alcohol, heroin, and then marijuana. As you may remember, we established three regional hubs to provide community-based services, treatment services, one in Paso Robles, San Luis Obispo, and in Grover Beach. And we did some modifications of the buildings and so forth. And then in 2012-13, we added the county jail. You can see that the services, the capacity was originally planned to be between 20 and 30 on a caseload, and so we're at capacity, meeting or exceeding some of that. Overall, the visits have expanded. We've conducted over 14,000 visits in the last year. The treatment program, the clients are coming 2 to 4 times a week, and the treatment program can be up to a year. Each offender is also provided a case manager, and those case managers help with housing, employment, the mental health systems, the physical health needs that they may have, and simple things such as driver's licenses so that they can get employed. So it's an all-encompassing package. As you've talked, as you've seen, the sober living environments has been key to us when the folks get out of prison. So if the clients or the offenders got treatment in jail, they were also likely to get treatment in the community settings. And lastly, some of our completion rates. The overall completion rate for treatment, which is quite an extensive program, is up to 56% overall. In general, these figures are very close to the state figures as well. Lastly, you saw in the prom video as well that if participants participate in treatment and are successful in treatment, their recidivism rate falls all the way to 15%. So recall that the average recidivism rate was 33%. So it's very important to us to work together, all of us, to keep the folks in treatment to have these best outcomes. Now, the treatment program is year long, and so we don't have a lot of numbers here, but we envision, especially with the mandatory supervision, to continue to keep folks in treatment and to work on it, various incentives to get that to happen.
And I think you have a question from Supervisor Hill.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Dr. Graber.
Hi.
On the sober living facilities and the great use of those, especially now, do we have enough do we have enough beds? And what does it usually take for a facility to, I guess, contract with behavioral health, or I'm not sure if it's through...
It's through behavioral health, correct.
Behavioral health, yeah.
Yeah, we have 154 beds. At any one point, we probably have 45 of them as sober living, as AB 109 offenders. So that includes all of the community beds, and no, there's not enough. We're still looking for more providers. We provide technical assistance, so a potential provider would call behavioral health department, and we would walk them through the process of what they need to get to do, how they need to get themselves set up, and we provide some of that technical assistance.
And this is shown to be a real critical part of our...
It's a very critical part, very critical. And right now what we're doing is working with the folks in sober living, the offenders, to become more and more self-sufficient,
right,
so that they begin to make co-pays on their sober living arrangements, and that will lead to more success in the real world where they pay rent and various things.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and staff had light on somewhere. Yeah, and what I wanted to do, Mr. Reyes, if I mind, is explore a little bit the connection between your supervision of probation and treatment under mental health or drug and alcohol services. Going back to the GPS monitoring, I forgot to ask at this point, about how many people are on GPS tracking at this point, any one time?
Well, in terms of our realigned population, it's anywhere from 30 to 40 of our offenders.
30 to 40.
On any given day, yeah, it will be on GPS.
And these folks are, there's also a supervised population that's not being GPS tracked.
Correct.
So the GPS trackers suggest to me a somewhat more serious offense or a different part of the system that you're needing to follow these people more closely.
It's primarily been used in initially because they didn't have a place to go. And so often when they got released from state prison, early on, the challenge was, did we have enough beds? And if they had to wait, it was from a supervision responsibility, it would seem smart to monitor them, so at least we knew where they were.
And so I guess where I'm going with this is that folks who are being GPS tracked are eligible for services.
Yes.
And, you know, that, and I guess the question then, as we hook it, all these things interconnected, as we hook back to the custody situation, do you see an opportunity for expanding GPS tracking and thus improving access to services? Is that part of your discussion at this point?
Yes, I see that there will continue to be a need, not only for monitoring, but also in lieu of incarceration, so that they're not in custody. One of the challenges, I think, with this population is what can you lock into them in terms of their motivation to be willing to take advantage of the services? Once we are able to do that, then I think it's promising. And once we could get them into a sober bed, once they're willing to get into treatment, and then I think that's the hope and the promise in order for them to turn their lives around and change their behavior.
Thank you. And you have the floor. I don't see questions from my colleagues.
No, that's fine. I'm good.
Thank you.
Jim Salio, Chief Probation Officer. So that concludes our update on AB 109 and how the county is addressing the realignment issues. The CCP, the Community Correction Partnership, continues to meet monthly. We keep working on refining the plan, and I think our county is a great model for how well collaboration has worked under realignment. So thank you.
And I wonder if I could just wrap it up by putting our CAO on the spot.
Demographics throughout the state to come together to try to figure out how to divvy that up, which that allocation just came out recently. One of the challenges for this year is that the base funding is $85 million less statewide than it was in the current year. Fortunately, there is what's called some growth money that can be used to help plug some of that gap. And we've done a nice job. Our Community Correction Partnership has done a nice job of budgeting and setting some funding aside from prior years to deal with a potential gap, whereas some other areas around the state haven't, and they have a bigger challenge on their hand. Last thing we want to do is pare back some of these programs. How we've fared, we're somewhere in the middle. You know, frankly, counties that have a bit more of a lock-em-up approach haven't fared as well, and we're kind of in the middle of that dynamic, if you will, in terms of funding.
Well, just to know that as CSAC, or State Association, and other associations like the Sheriff's and Probation Officers and the DAs deal with it, this is a little bit of a road bump this year because of some assumptions made, but we're hopeful that tracking forward, we're going to start to see some more predictable growth. Mr. Hill?
Just a quick question while we have the Chief here and also Deputy Chief Reyes. As Dr. Graber pointed out, one of the things that we, as this expands and our responsibility grows, we certainly need more sober living facilities. How about the actual housing of the folks? I mean, because we've talked about that in a lot of programs we're undertaking with homelessness and others, and, you know, just having units available as, you know, part of the whole idea is to help these folks become self-sufficient, become law-abiding citizens, not reoffend, and so we want to get them out of facilities at some point and into their own living units. And is that also a challenge that we're facing?
Finding
apartments and
yes, I think that is a challenge as far as finding places. But most of the people we're talking about are you know, single males,
right?
And so finding a room for them to rent or something like that's important. So we have a little more opportunity to try to help them find housing. But the first step is obviously to get them sober and not using drugs, and then find employment for them, which is something that we're working on. And then the third is then to help them find stable housing.
And do we have a sense, Chief, of the average amount of time it takes for someone to kind of transition from the sober living facility and all the things that go in to help them, you know, get on their feet and stay clean and stay, you know, stay out of reoffending, and then be able to get a job and become self-sufficient where they're, you know,
right,
citizens that we want to see?
Well, and the average stay is about 90 days in the SLEs, sober living environments.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of a gauge on how long it takes them to transition out. Now, you can stay in a sober living environment longer if you pay your own way there and that kind of thing. So Sometimes that becomes a longer stay because they're working and they have a place to live and that kind of thing. The subsidized, the county subsidized portion is usually about 90 days.
And then, and have we've seen the success of people being able to get jobs and help to subsidize to pay them, you know, for to stay in the SLEs?
I think so. I think, again, it's closely related to their getting clean and sober. So if they're clean and sober and able to hold a job and those kind of things, and then also, too, working on the antisocial behavior, because just because they're clean and sober, there's other antisocial behaviors that sometimes prohibit them from keeping jobs.
Right.
So we need to work on those issues, too. But that's a big focus, is to try to keep them employed and keep them on the straight and narrow, obviously.
So I guess that raises a last question I think I have, which is it more beneficial then to see them in these SLEs where, you know, they're able to get as much service to, you know, to really help, you know, because our goal, everybody's goal is prevent recidivism, let's get these folks on the, you know, on the straight and narrow working and becoming self-sufficient citizens. And so is there a benefit to some degree for them to, you know, beyond the 90 days, for them to stay in these environments and to get peer support as well as the services?
Yeah, I mean, we encourage people to, you know, stay as long as they need to stay, but we do want to get them to a point where they're supporting themselves and
sure.
It's not being supported by the county dollars, because we only have so much dollars to spread around. And so the quicker we can get them to be self-sufficient so they're supporting themselves in the sober living environments, the more people we can obviously serve.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you all. An interesting and challenging bit of work here, and appreciate your efforts on it.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we're going to take a short break, reconvene at 10:45. If the electronics don't fail us, and there's always a chance that they will, but it appears that we're working, we will reconvene and ask.
And so, what was that?
We submitted it.
But we brought one in case. Down below. Thanks for the pointers.
We
thought there was a little confusion there.
We're just lucky we have computers these days, but you know.
Is it one of these?
There we are. That looks promising.
Sorry, too many things.
Okay. So, good morning. We want to... We're going to shift gears back to water, back to creeks, back to our biological setting in our county, and kind of review the accomplishments that the RCDs and the county have had in the past year related to the first phase of the SLO County Watershed Management Plan, and then also talk about where we're going and what next steps we are starting to follow. And then also how we're interacting with the community and other partnerships to make sure that this is a successful effort. And so these are our county watershed areas. Through the Phase 1 County Watershed Management Plan, we did assess the different boundaries of watersheds within our county and looked at the Cal Water Hydrologic Unit 10 to... which is basically just the scale of watershed that is more appropriate to our county. Instead of it being at a very broad regional state scale, sometimes multiple watersheds are grouped in different ways. They can be different shapes and sizes, but this scale is sort of a scale that we thought was approachable to the county and future planning efforts. And so there was some modifications of certain boundaries depending on the local characteristics and community's input on that. But this is sort of the primary watershed areas, and there's about 25 of them.
So we talk a lot about what watersheds are, or what watersheds are, and then
trying to get a sense of, we all live in a watershed, whether we're talking about the Mississippi River or San Luis Obispo Creek, we're all within a watershed. But a lot of times people don't quite understand what a watershed does, what its functions are, how we're integrated with the watershed itself. Here you can see an artist's rendition of San Luis Obispo County. And as you move from left to right, which would be west to east, you'd see that we have greater precipitation occurring along the coastline and less occurring inland areas. You can also see that we have some groundwater basins kind of outlined in there. But we all live within this area. This is our watersheds that we have. And here are some examples of some of the functions that they have. Groundwater infiltration, that's a hot topic these days. Groundwater release in springs and streams, nutrient cycling in productive soils, food, fiber, fuel, flood control, recreation, wildlife habitat, and aesthetics of open space. These are all part of the key functions that a watershed can provide, whether you're talking about the Mississippi River or, like I said, San Luis Obispo Creek, something closer to home. Next slide. But what is watershed restoration? We hear that a lot of times. Well, watershed restoration is to sustain and enhance watershed functions that provide the goods and services and values desired by the community affected by conditions within a watershed boundary. So what does that mean in a nutshell? It's basically, what are the things that we're looking for that would provide the services that we are looking for in a watershed, a healthy watershed? It could be fishing, it could be water quality, it could be flood control. But those are all services that we're trying to achieve as a community to restore our watersheds. Next slide, please. So our management plan that we developed collaboratively worked on a countywide level to prioritize watershed restoration efforts. It also is looking to increase value or increase knowledge and value of ecosystem services and watersheds and communities, and also to strengthen competitiveness with watershed restoration projects when competing at a county level for IRWM and other funds. These are some of the things that are outcomes from the management plan, and we hope that will be seen implemented in the near future.
And so one of the strengths of a watershed management plan is that it documents the issues and needs of an area and really portrays them to the outside world in a neat fashion. So when you ask the state for money, when you ask the federal government from whoever you're asking from, they really know that you have you've gone through the thought process. They can really clearly see what the needs, issues are, and how you plan on fixing that. And so we've outlined these three phases for our watershed management plan. The first phase we are completing currently. We have a description of each of those 25 watersheds, or called a watershed snapshot, which tries to boil down kind of the hot topics that people should be considering in the county. So it could be water, vegetation, the demographics of a certain watershed. And all of those are, there's the same format for all of those across the board. And so that was one of our struggles with in our county is there's a lot of variation in data and the types of data. And so we tried to create a single snapshot for each watershed so they could be compared to each other. There was also a data gap analysis using that characterization or snapshot. And then we started researching different ways or indicators or signs of watershed health that could be used to tell us when something is going awry, if we just look at this piece of the puzzle, we know that that's going to be our signal, our canary in the coal mine of maybe we should start paying more attention to that particular piece of the system. We also completed a Slo County in-stream flow assessment that we hope will be working with your staff more and integrating into the Master Water Report and other activities. And then we did hold technical advisory meetings and some watershed working group meetings to help drive the watershed boundaries and the watershed snapshots themselves. And then to get the information out into the world in a way that is a little more approachable than a report, there was a slowwatershedproject.org website created. And so everyone can go to that website and put in their address and zoom out and figure out, well, I'm next to this creek and I'm in this watershed. And I can then go to that watershed snapshot and figure out, well, who are the players in that watershed and what are the issues as we know them today? So I would encourage everyone to go to that site. We're going to, as much as possible, start putting information there it's very approachable. There were a number of findings that are detailed in that report, but just sort of the major ones, where there's a lack of information about watershed health and the system's perspective, and so the links that really exist between our natural resources. And so we talk a lot about groundwater, and we're focused on groundwater, but you know, there's of course a surface water connection with groundwater, and there's other connections to the whole landscape that should be looked at and aren't very well portrayed in the existing information that is out there. The coastal watersheds tended to have more information than inland watersheds. There are 7 watershed management plans currently, and those tended to be in the coastal areas. And so there's been some level of effort to figure out and talk with the community, what are those issues, what should we be doing about those issues, whereas in the inland, it's not quite as organized. Previous reports did not account for climate change in the future. Of course, you know, we were thinking about what we knew at that time. And so now with a changing future, we need to start thinking about how that will be integrated into our information and management systems. And then a large number of data gaps, or the largest number of data gaps, were really related to groundwater percolation, base flows, surface water quality, groundwater health. So being able to fulfill those data gaps is going to, of course, improve what the solutions are to fixing those issues.
So one of the key points about this plan is that it doesn't sit wholly separate from all the other plans. It actually is really supposed to be integrated with a lot of the plans we have here at the county level, groundwater management plans, salt nutrient management plans, et cetera. And our goal is actually to work with county planning and public works departments and start bringing our management plan as part of their plan as well. And as it slowly evolves, working collaboratively with each other. So this is a living document. It's not one time we're done, put it on the shelf, and we'll come back to it in a couple of years. It will be constantly updated as we go. We are hoping that this is something that sort of fills in a lot of gaps for where these plans are at currently and in the future as well. Next slide. So how do we go about doing this? Looking forward into the future, we need to determine what our indicators are. Here's an example of some of the indicators you can look at and how they're all interrelated to each other. On some aspects, you have sort of the biological, chemical, physical properties of a watershed, but then on the other side, you also have the economic and social components of a watershed framework. And they all do interact with each other. They may not be all completely equal, but they do interact. So one of the next plans for us is to go through and determine which indicators are useful for us in our watersheds and how they interrelate to each other.
Of backgrounds. So if you didn't see your little, you know, I noticed that the Ag Liaison Board and, you know, certain other entities weren't shown on that particular slide, but they would definitely be part of the process. And so to continue along that vein, we are building partnerships currently. We've had conversations with the Community Foundation and their Action for Healthy Communities, which currently looks at indicators, but more from the social economic side, and so how we can maybe expand on what they're doing to beef up the physical environment component. We've also been talking with the Land Conservancy, Central Coast Salmon Enhancement, multiple environmental organizations, community members, your staff, the resource agencies, Cal Poly. We're really in that stage of where are our strengths going to be and where can we really get the most leverage. And so if we are working with, you know, Cal Poly, there's a little bit of staff and resources and expertise and, you know, volunteer time that's available there. And that's the same kind of across the board with many of these partners is who has some extra staff time, some extra funding, other resources that we can be using to make sure that we continue the momentum of this project. And so for you in particular, we hope that you can continue to support this effort. We will be looking for funding, both state, federal, other funding, So writing support letters and other ways of showing that the county themselves are behind this effort and it's not just the RCDs kind of working in our own little world is useful and does help acquire funds. We'd also encourage county staff to continue their engagement. We've had conversations with the Public Works Department, the Planning Department, and trying to figure out how this management plan connects to all the others and how it could be an umbrella. We've heard a lot through the Water Summit and, you know, just conversations over the last several years about groundwater sustainability, resiliency in general. And so the watershed management plan could be some kind of umbrella that we actually call our plan a watershed management plan, but it meets all the mandates of a groundwater sustainability plan or a stormwater management plan or a climate action plan. And so trying to figure out how what the best position for this umbrella plan really can be. And then we'd ask that you could assist in funding the state of our watersheds assessment, which is the next phase of the plan. And so that is where Devin was talking about the indicators of watershed health, and it would include identifying those indicators for the entire county. It would include evaluating two pilot watersheds against those indicators with existing data, and then going to the community and seeing how they respond to those indicators and the findings of that data against the indicators. What are their recommendations on moving forward and action steps in moving forward? So we're estimating that type of process would cost around $300,000 for two pilot watersheds. But it is a scalable number. Ideally, we wouldn't break it up into little components, but you know, every little bit helps. So just starting with the indicators, just figuring out, well, what do we as a county want to use as our signals for when a certain piece of the system isn't working, and then build off of that, because every little bit that we are able to do kind of locally makes it stronger when we're competing at that state level for grants. And the RCDs are really great at getting grants, and so we're definitely going to be keeping our eye on those potential opportunities as well. So with that, I'd like to thank you.
All right. Let me open it then to my colleagues for questions. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you. What do you see as the biggest challenge you have for the implementation, other than funding? What's the biggest challenge that you have out there?
Probably some of it's just getting the collaboration going on. There's already a lot of groups moving and working together, but having somewhere to sort of house them in those watershed working groups is one. And then the other is probably a lot of it is getting down to some of the regulatory process, going through those loopholes. We've got some RCDs are pretty good at getting a lot of permit coordination going in place. And that's one of the services we can provide. But as far as developing a plan, it's going to get a lot of the groups into the room talking to each other and getting the conversations going.
I spoke to a young group last Friday, two classes, and I send them your emails so that hopefully you can talk to them. It's about watershed management, about water, what we see for the future of our county. So hopefully you'll have an opportunity.
You're starting to understand. A couple of questions. One of them is, you know, this summary report talks in general about watershed plans that exist and data gaps. Could you give us just very briefly, pick a watershed that has a plan. What kind of data are we missing?
Do you want to talk about yours and I'll talk about mine?
So I would say across the board, Arroyo Grande Creek, Pismo Creek, okay. Most creeks in our county are missing base flow data.
Okay.
So you put often there's a stream gauge. Well, in some cases there's a stream gauge, in some cases there's not a stream gauge. But when there is, it's measuring or trying to capture the flood event and not necessarily the base flow event.
Okay.
And so all that information around, well, can steelhead still pass this area? Is there steelhead habitat? And how much water is in the creek for the other, you know, macroinvertebrates, et cetera? And what does that then tell us about the groundwater piece because of the interactions?
Okay. And that's just the kind of example. I assume that all inland, coastal, they're all the same. I wonder if somebody from Public Works could comment. This was prepared as part of our Integrated Regional Water Management Plan update. And I'd be interested in Public Works' perspective on how that fits into a lot of other things that we're doing. I mean, managing our watersheds, obviously, you know, a good idea, but what are our opportunities here, and what are our chances of keeping this going, ongoing funding?
Yes, thank you. Mark Hutchinson, Department of Public Works. I believe a majority of this work was funded through IRWM funding, so we plan to use that source. Obviously, it's a competitive process, and we work through the Regional Water Management Group. I should point out that the groundwater sustainability legislation that just came out of Sacramento does require a watershed component to each and every one of these groundwater sustainability plans. So we've already made that connection, obviously, and are interested in continuing to work with the RCD on how to bring that information in. The watershed planning links to a lot of efforts that that are ongoing. Nicole mentioned Arroyo Grande Creek. We have an HCP underway. We have five stream gauges on Arroyo Grande Creek collecting data. So this ability to use the watershed plan and the website that's been set up to locate all of that data and information so that's available to everyone working is a great opportunity to move forward with.
It seems to me that focusing on watershed by watershed, it's a fundamentally powerful tool. If it's important to our own ongoing efforts and a variety of other actions, I guess concerned isn't the right word, but you know, this seems like something we should be establishing a long-term funding stream for, and these competitive grants out of DWR may or may not be the way to do it. And I was just curious as to whether we have a sense that this is something we're going to be able to sustain, or does this report get written and set aside for some years?
Well, with the groundwater sustainability requirements, and Public Works is engaged and has been for a week or two, but heavily this week and the next, to get our arms around all of the tasks that have to be accomplished throughout San Luis Obispo County. And relate those to funding resources. I think it's premature to state where money might come from on a long-term basis. There's so much that we do now through the IRWM process that the state has made wholly dependent on the grant process. Okay. They do not make long-term commitments to funding to any of those programs.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
Mark, with the Proposition 1 on the ballot, would there be an opportunity out of that $100 million for funding of various sorts, could that be utilized in some of this effort?
Well, we expect that it would be. But as you're aware, Proposition 1 is on the ballot. It's polling quite well. If it does pass, then the legislature will take up legislation to tell us what it actually says and how that money will be made available. So we won't really know what the scoring and the weighting and the criteria are for some months.
This question goes to Devin. Devin, I know that we've spoke about this in the past, and you've corrected my terminology in terms of the catch basin. There's a different term we can use that can help the process along. But I know that I would encourage Public Works to speak with RCD about the possibility of using, there's a couple of areas that they've already identified, to do something in case we do get some kind of a rain. Is there something that we can do? So hopefully we can engage in discussion, and if there's any way that the county can help with this, I would really encourage us to do so.
Very good. With no other questions at the dais, I do have a couple of requests to speak. Eric Greening, followed by Dorothy.
How much the county is able to muster right now. We have, hopefully, coming soon, even though it's a horrible thing, we hope it comes soon because it means rain coming soon, a massive first flush, probably one of the most massive we've ever had, simply because it has been so dry for so long. So much oil has been dripping on so much pavement in so many places for so long and not been washed away. When we finally, hopefully, get something robust enough to wash it off the pavement. It will go into the creeks and into the oceans. Who, where is monitoring? Who, where is responsible for a plan to essentially prevent what we can, even if not in time for this upcoming, hopefully soon, event? Who, where will take the final responsibility? Because having these huge sluices of hydrocarbons go straight into our creeks and then into the ocean is definitely not good medicine and can undo a lot of the other valuable work. I would say that discussions at the RAC have brought up some of the same issues about data gaps relative to what we can in general call environmental flows. In other words, the baseline flows, whether they are sufficient for anadromous fish, whether they promote temperatures sufficient for anadromous fish. Another issue is whether there is yearling habitat. And that actually, to some extent, depends on erosion. A stabilized creek isn't always the healthiest creek for anadromous fish. To have areas where there's active bank cutting, both to liberate spawning gravel and to create overhung pools, can actually be a good thing in the functioning of a watershed. Obviously not where there's a building next to it, but it can be a good thing. Anyway, lots of topics, lots of good work, and please keep going with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Ms. Jennings?
I am Dorothy Jennings from Templeton. Watershed information is on a countywide basis is vital to making informed decisions about water. I applaud you for engaging the local RCDs in this important work. The Watershed Management Plan, Phase 1, is an important repository of information on which to build. A watershed management plan is consistent with the tenets detailed in the conservation and open space element. That is to base decisions on what watershed information. Groundwater basin boundaries and subbasin boundaries do not reveal the complete picture. Excluding tributaries is like you and I functioning without our arms and legs. Quality water use decisions necessitate studying in detail an array of information about each watershed. For example, stream gauge data, identification and protection of recharge areas, and understanding the benefits of retaining water for percolation using healthy riparian areas, and so forth. I urge you to take the next steps, whatever they may be, to expand Phase 1 work and begin to fill in the data gaps and to develop watershed indicators. Life in our county, as we know it today, is dependent on managing water as a sustainable commodity, watershed by watershed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jennings. That was our last request to speak, and seeing no one coming forward, we'll close it to the public. Bring it back to the board. Thank the RCDs and Public Works and Planning, others that are involved in this. A focus on watersheds important, and we'll look forward to next steps. Thanks for being here today. With that, Madam Clerk, would you introduce our next item, please?
Item number 18, a hearing to consider a resolution setting forth a determination of established vested rights at the Whale Rock Pit, Cayucas Pit, California Mine ID 91-40-0010, located at 1424 Old Creek Road, east of the community of Cayucas, including the scope and nature of surface mining activities included within the established vested rights. Hearing continued from June 17, 2014, and it is recommended that this hearing be continued to November 25, 2014. District 2.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Mr. Wilson?
Good morning, board members. I am here today just to let you know that the item has been continued. We've been in communications. Wait for just
cattle,
a moment.
Cattle drive is coming in here, so we don't. There we go.
So we've been in communications with the applicant and their attorney on the matters that we spoke out at your last hearing. We've still got some unresolved issues that we're working with the applicant on. And we're continuing our communications with them, and hopefully we'll have everything resolved so as to not have a debate about the issue.
Item number 19, public needs hearing to consider the proposed annual 2015 action plan for the Community Development Block Grant, Home Investment Partnerships Act, and Emergency Solutions Grant Programs, all districts.
Mr. Keith.
Thank you, Chairman.
There's a yellow light to your left, I think.
Thank you. There we are. Thank you, Supervisors. Trevor Keith, Planning and Building. So today we have a presentation for you, and it's regarding it's our annual 2015 action plan for the Community Development Block Grant, the Home Investment Partnership Act, and the Emergency Solution Grant Programs. And so today we have staff member Susan Adai to give you the presentation.
Is there Adai?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the board, Susanna Adai. And today's needs hearing, it's the needs hearing for the 2015 action plan and the consolidated plan. The consolidated plan is, the consolidated plan, it's a five-year strategic plan for federal funds that the county will receive from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, known as HUD. And it's a required document and starts from program year 2015 to 2019. This plan provides an assessment of needs for housing, homeless, and community development. And it also includes a strategic plan to address those needs. It comes with an annual action plan outlining specific projects to be funded with HUD funds. The 2015 action plan, it's the first action plan of this consolidated plan, and it outlines or lists specific projects to be funded under the Community Development Block Grant Program, Home Program, and Emergency Solutions Grant Program. In order to prepare the action plan and the consolidated plan, we need to engage the public and obtain their input about the community needs. We started the public participation process in September by holding two public workshops in the North County and another one in the South County. We also held a needs hearing at the City of San Luis Obispo. We conducted surveys. It's called the Needs Assessment Survey, and we translated it into Spanish and published it on social media. And also we made presentations to numerous advisory and stakeholder groups. So here's a summary of needs. And as you can see on the list, there is a strong need for homeless services and shelters, healthcare facilities for seniors and homeless persons, and so on. Now I will quickly review each CDBG, each grant program. CDBG program or the Community Development Block Program, it turned 40 this year, and it's a flexible program, and it's aimed at a variety of community projects. Any project that is applying for CDBG program, they have to meet three national objectives, and they are benefit low, moderate income persons, prevent or eliminate slum and blight, and meet an urgent community need. Eligible CDBG activity, it can fall under housing, public services, public facilities, and economic development. Now, home program. Home program or Home Investment Partnerships Program. The purpose of this program is to create affordable housing for low-income families, and that can be done by construction or rehabilitation of affordable housing units. And this program also provides down payment assistance to low-income families and rental assistance. ESG program or the Emergency Solutions Grant Program. The purpose of this program is to prevent homelessness and enable homeless persons to move toward independent living. qualified activities are renovation and rehabilitation of building structures for use of emergency shelters or transitional housing, case management services, and operating costs. So now the timeline. We plan to publish the draft action plan and the consolidated plan. The Exhibit A was attached to the staff report. That Exhibit A shows the summary of needs that can be funded with CDBG. So we have an attachment one, Exhibit A, and that lists the needs. Right. And so these are the needs that are qualified to be funded with community development block grant. And then it says affordable housing, homelessness services, public services, and economic development. And also it can be used under public facilities.
If I may, just to add, Dan Buckshy, County Administrator, some of what you may be referring to, Supervisor Ray, is the other process where we have for community input for what we call Fund Center 106, which is other community programs.
Okay. Yeah.
Some of those programs you mentioned are funded through that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Very good. Mr. Hill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I look through Attachment 1 and some of the, I guess, the comments and needs, I just want to say this to our staff because I think it's important. You know, we have now a fair number of programs, especially one that the county is funding with 50 Now, homeless outreach for chronic homeless, and other money that's come into social services, and also through behavioral health and even some of the agencies. The greatest need by far that we've heard continuously is for units. And so the more money that we can put into, you know, what we're seeing in other communities is moving away from the temporary sheltering and those things and the actual construction of the units, of the housing units, because in our community there's no greater real need, I think, at every level of income, and certainly for people who are chronically homeless. And that's the whole federal turn towards the housing first, which is stabilized first with units. So I think whatever we can do with, I know these funds get limited and it's highly competitive, but whatever we can do to help get units either, you know, built or rehabbed for the use of the people who access, whether it's homeless folks or the lower income, I think has got to be our biggest priority. A lot of these things that I see are kind of old in terms of, well, that's the way things used to be. That's not the way we're doing things anymore. And so I really hope that we're able to better prioritize, you know, the limited amount of funds we have towards units on the ground, or units that maybe we're able to take over and rehab for use, because that's where the greatest need. You know, we have put more funding probably, and certainly Mr. Buckshy could talk to that if he needed to, funding towards some of these services than ever before, but we still have that big missing part.
May I add?
Would you like to respond?
Yes. I would like to add that this process, the public participation process, we did a survey, and this process is a data-driven process. So the data is showing us that there is a great need for homeless services, homeless or housing for homeless purposes. So I think that this consolidated plan that defines our strategies and priorities, it's homeless theme consolidated plan that will prioritize the homelessness and any services related to homelessness for the upcoming federal funds.
Yeah, and I understand. I'm just saying I think that more so now, probably this last year, we have both the county and through monies that have come in through our other agencies within the county, we have more money for services than ever before. What we don't have is places to actually house people that will receive these services. And so that's why there needs to be an understanding that we have more money for the services where, you know, certainly those needs have always been there and still are, but we actually have more, you know, we're hiring more caseworkers, we're seeing more money for vets, we're seeing more money for the chronic homeless. But where are we going to house them? Where are we going to stabilize them in units? That's the missing piece.
All right. Mr. Meacham.
Thanks. I wanted to follow up on Supervisor Ray's point on, I did look at Attachment A, but obviously there's not specific projects that are attached to any of this at this point in time. And Mr. Buckshaw, you mentioned Fund 106. Is that where some of those will see that?
Yeah, you'll see, and I'd let folks from planning comment more on this process. But after the community input is gathered and the needs are identified, you'll come back with proposals for how to spend these particular funds, the CDBG, the home, and the emergency shelter grants. Separately, we have the process that will commence with the start of the 15-16 budget year, which is our preventative health program and our community-based organizations, which is largely funded with some tobacco settlement funding in the general fund. And that's where there's a much broader set of programs, some of which Supervisor Ray referred to. So that'll occur as part of the 15-16 budget process.
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with the focus on housing issues and all the needs there, but by the same token, some of these
process and application process has gotten so onerous that many of our very important facilities that are the smaller facilities, local facilities in our county, just didn't have the staffing to apply successfully for HUD funds, and we last year decided to take a look at that, kind of separating more instead of giving some of our bigger organizations like TEMA, like CAPSLO, that have large staffs that can work with HUD, let them go after the HUD funding and keep a lot of the 106 funds for the local small the groups. And one perfect example in my district is North County Connection. They're a sober living, been there a long time, been doing great work, the kind of work we listened to in our last presentation that's so necessary, but doesn't have the staffing to really successfully apply for HUD. So it's my hope that planning will help work with some of those folks where we really need to help them get through the application process to their boots on the ground. They're working hard, but sometimes they fall through the cracks when it comes to meeting the regulatory necessities of successfully applying for the monies. So I think it's going to be a great year, and we're going to really get a lot done. And Suzanne, thank you all for what you're doing.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ms. Arm. And Mr. Buckshaw, did you want to weigh in? Also, Supervisor Hill.
I could just brief. I just wanted to follow up to Supervisor Meacham's point and question about the different categories. In Attachment A, it lists the different categories: affordable housing, homelessness service, public services, economic development, and public facilities. And planning staff may be able to help me out here, but I believe HUD states how much can be spent in any one particular category. There are maximum amounts, so you won't see all the funding going to one area. It will be spread amongst these different categories according to the HUD guidelines.
And I just real briefly, Mr. Chair, wanted to add on to Supervisor Arnold's point. And that'll come up, and there is a committee that works on it. But I do think staff should be aware that, and we have been made aware of it, that some of the bigger agencies have the ability to apply successfully and meet all the reporting requirements and those sorts of things, and it does have a tendency to edge out a lot of the smaller ones in communities because they just, I mean, there's I can think of some in South County, too, that just don't have paid staff, period, but they're providing certain kinds of services, including sober living and other things. We'd hate to see, it creates a certain difficulty, I know, for all of us because we want to fund everything we possibly can that's improving the community. But there is a time where some of these bigger agencies can pretty much handle it on their own in terms of applying, and that maybe we need to focus on some of the smaller ones that provide as well. So I think that's a well-considered point that Supervisor Arnold made.
All right. With that, one of the important parts of today's item is the public hearing on needs, and so I will open it to the public. I have a number of requests to speak. We'll start with Daniela Dornan, followed by Steve Tanaka.
Hello, Chairman Gibson and members of the board. My name is Daniela Dornan, and I work in the Planning and Program Development Department for the Community Action Partnership, also known as CAPSLO. On behalf of CAPSLO, I would like to thank the board for your continued support of our homeless services programs, including the Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter and Prado Day Center. While there has been an increased emphasis as of late on case management to assist homeless individuals and families in locating and maintaining housing, the need for sheltering remains high. Housing our clients is always the priority, but for many of them, the need to stabilize their situation, including getting help with mental health, substance abuse, or other issues contributing to their homelessness, must occur before they can begin to look for housing. In addition, with housing resources so limited in our county, many of our clients who are ready to enter housing either cannot find housing or are on waiting lists, and Prado and Maxine Lewis are the only options available to them. With the passage of the Hearth Act in 2010, funding for sheltering has been capped, but the expenses of operating sheltering has not. I urge you to consider continued support for the Prado Day Center and the Maxine Lewis Memorial Center. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dornan. Mr. Tanaka, followed by Shauna Pruitt.
Good morning. Excuse me. Steve Tanaka with Wallace Group. I am here representing the San Miguel Community Services District. I have been their district engineer for the past 14 years. And we've been fortunate to have received a number of CDBG grant monies in the past for much-needed projects in the community. As you know, San Miguel is a disadvantaged community. We seem to always have a long laundry list of much-needed infrastructure improvement projects, both water and sewer. This year, we have submitted one application for it's related to the San Lawrence Terrace well. In San Miguel, this is one of our only three wells, so we do have some issues with water supply.
Continued support of my organization. I'm also here on behalf of the San Luis Supportive Housing Consortium and would like to take this opportunity to speak about the importance of TBRA assistance, which is tenant-based rental assistance. The goal of these funds is to assist individuals and families in finding decent, safe, affordable housing and or retaining their current housing and being able to maintain their housing after the rental assistance is ended. TBRA has been a critical element for assisting the special needs populations for the member agencies of the Supportive Housing Consortium. Most of these citizens are extremely low income and require additional support services in order to get to their highest level of independence possible. TBRA has been instrumental in helping these individuals secure stable housing in our community through the security deposit loans, short-term rental assistance, and emergency rental assistance programs. Housing would be unattainable for these individuals and families without this financial help. The partner agencies also provide case management, and it's in kind while this assistance is being funded. And we anticipate that the funds will be utilized quickly and will be able to reduce the number of homeless in our community. I also would like to give an advocacy letter to Suzanne, who is our monitor.
Thank you, Ms. Pruitt. Ms. Bellefontaine, followed by Laverne Buckman.
Good morning. I'm Kathleen Bellefontaine with the chairperson for the Commission on Aging in San Luis Obispo County. I'm concerned about speaking for the affordable housing rehabilitation funds and trying to target an idea here that or emphasize the idea that is not insignificant. One of our most important goals is to keep our seniors who are frail independent and safe in their homes as long as possible. Many of our seniors are living in HUD housing.
And no need to lean in, Ms. Bellefontaine. Stand tall, talk to us, and it'll all work out.
Okay. At the commission, you have to have your
yeah.
mouth around the mic.
Yeah.
So. All right. Thank you. The situation is that when people can no longer stay in their HUD housing, which indicates that they're low-income folks in the first place, our community does not offer a lot of assisted living out there, which is the next step when you can't live independently in your own home. And, in fact, many people are moved out of our county for that reason. So I'm advocating for grab bars and handrails with the HUD funding that goes with the rehabilitation part, because those two items are the things that can be put into homes. CAPSLO has done a lot of this over years with their home maintenance program, but they run out of funds sometimes within the first third of the physical year. And they have a waiting list for people that need maybe not just handrails, but they have a waiting list. So there's a great need out there for our seniors or for people who are disabled to just have that handbar and ask, you know, you ask your EMT folks when they go out for some of these falls, what room are they finding these seniors in their bathrooms, that going over the side of the bathtub trying to get out, you know, just not being able to get up properly from the toilet. So I know it's, you know, down-to-earth things that we're talking about here, but if things can be targeted that closely, that's what I'm speaking here for. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bellefontaine. Ms. Buckman, followed by Marina Washburn.
Hi, my name is Laverne Buckman, and I'm from San Miguel, a longtime resident there. I'm actively involved in the community, including chairing the San Miguel Design Community Design Committee, where we discussed some long-neglected infrastructure needs in San Miguel. And today I'm here to encourage you to support the San Miguel CSD application for the San Lawrence Terrace well improvements. This is a critical need in our district. When the San Lawrence Terrace well was first conveyed to the CSD from the county years ago, it had already been abandoned. So the district constructed a new well with the help of CDBG grant. However, the arsenic levels became very quickly a problem. And from that point on, have remained a significant issue for the district. And the district needs to move forward with the
needs. For sites that are community assets that provide or can provide or will provide a resource for our low-income community, and that's the Dana Adobe in Apomo, one of, I'm sure, many projects you have. But I wanted to, again, it's a different pot of money. It's the public facility improvement fees that will increase accessibility to our site. And I just wanted to come and advocate for those community needs as well in our low-income community and, you know, what Napomo down South Oakland looks like. So thank you again for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Washburn. That was our last request to speak. And seeing no one coming forward, I'll go ahead and close it to the public, bring it back to the board, and ask staff to summarize what our next steps are. You had it up a minute ago, so if we could just hear that one more time, we'll be moving on.
So next step is to release a draft action plan and consolidated plan in January 2015 for a 30-day public review. And then we will come back to your board in March to approve the two plans. And in May 15th, 2015, we have to submit the two documents to HUD.
Very good. All right. With no questions further from the Ms. Arnold?
No. Do we need to motion to receive this? Is that what our recommendation is?
I think so. It was just a matter of hearing public testimony and receiving the presentation. So I think we're good there. Well, thanks, staff, for their continued work, making recommendations on the distribution of scarce resources in the face of great needs. That was our last business item for the day, actually, and the last thing that's noted on our agenda is the introduction of the Cattleman of the Year, and I wonder who from the Cattlemen's Association might come forward to make that presentation, Mr. Evanson or...
Good morning, Board. I'm Dale Evenson from President of San Luis Obispo County Cattlemen Association. Some of you here in the realm have noticed me in the past years. And what I'm going to do today is bring the presentation forward of our 2014-15 Cattlemen of the Year. This San Luis Obispo County Cattlemen Association is very proud to introduce County native Dan Wixom as the 2014 Cattlemen of the Year. He and his wife, Carla, reside in Morro Bay. Many of you remember Dan's father, Dr. Dave Wixom, who is the only large animal veterinarian on the coast for many years. Dan, a graduate of Cal Poly in the Ag Business Management, bought his first herd of cows at the ripe old age of 16 from his great-grandfather, Will Holland, who was also a well-known rancher on the coast. From that time on, Dan has continued to build his herd to one of the best Angus-based commercial cow-calf operations in the county, always focusing on top genetics that have resulted in the outstanding mechanization or merchandising of his yearly calf crop. Besides his cattle, Dan has always owned trucks and was involved in the concrete business. In 1984, he bought that business and sold it in 1997. His cattle trucking business takes him all over the states of California, Oregon, and at all hours of the day and night. Every Saturday, you can be found transporting at least one or two loads into the cattle market areas, such as Templeton Livestock Market. And when Dan isn't hauling his cattle, is either busy farming or most likely helping his neighbors working their cattle. He is always just a phone call away when branding or shipping time comes. His daughter Sarah and her husband Garrett Hansen make several trips down from Linden to help. Dan, like so many of you, went through the 4-H and FFA programs, showed their animals here at the local fair. Now he and Carla are here year in and out, supporting both the replacement heifer auction and the junior livestock auction, always giving back to the youth and in his community. He is a longtime member of the San Luis Obispo County Cattlemen's and the State National Association. Dan belongs to the County, State, and National Farm Bureau Organization. He is a member of the Caballeros, member and past president of the Native Sons of the Golden West, and a founding board member of the Coast National Bank. Acknowledging his many accomplishments, dedication, and commitment to an ever-changing industry, and his outstanding contributions to the beef industry, as well as his community, it is easy to...
Good choice. I know that the year's been a challenging year for our cattlemen here in the county. The drought cycle's been a tough one, diminishing all the feed throughout the county. And then this year, something even more challenging maybe, in that we, after almost 70 years in existence, our local livestock marketing facility has closed its doors this month, as a matter of fact. So, most of us kind of shared a tear there at the beginning of the month. But I know you all are resilient, and I know that from experience you're all resilient, and will continue as beef producers to provide a nutritious source of food for our county and our entire nation. So thank you for being here and sharing the day with us.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, sir. So let me just wrap up the business items here. We are not doing closed session. So at this point, we are going to adjourn the meeting for the day. The board will join the cattlemen's at the traditional lunch at the Madonna Inn, and we'll look forward to seeing you all next week. We're done. Thanks.